And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
One big winner in the election just passed was Alex Padilla, who was appointed to the United States Senate in 2021 to replace Kamala Harris and won a resounding mandate for a full term from the voters of California last week. Son of Mexican immigrants, Padilla has a remarkable personal story, which I discussed with him yesterday, along with the meaning of these surprising national results. Here's that conversation. Senator Padilla, it's so good to be with you. I want to start off by congratulating you. You had a pretty prodigious victory on November 8th.
Thank you. Thank you. It is California, so they're still counting votes, but the margin is certainly big. And being able to settle in as an elected United States senator, just an appointed United right. States senator is, it just feels tremendous to think that the voters of California have once again put their trust and confidence in me and the fight that I bring on their behalf to the United States Senate. But also, I got to confess, I constantly think back on my life journey, starting with, my parents who are immigrants from Mexico, my dad for many years working as a short order cook, my mom cleaning houses. It's one of those only in America stories that in one generation.
I want to explore that story. And that's really why I was so interested in talking to you. But because this election took such an unexpected turn, I want to talk a little bit about this, because I don't know how many people had on their bingo cards that Democrats would be in a position to actually add a seat in the U.S. Senate and that Republicans would be struggling to gain a majority in the House. And, and there were some significant Democratic victories in state races around the country as well. What do you ascribe this to? Because, history did not portend this. History suggests the incumbent party takes a beating, especially when the president's approval rating is relatively low. The economy is rated relatively low. What happened, do you think?
I got to tell you, I was too surprised, at least not on the Senate side, because I knew my four colleagues who were considered more not vulnerable, but in tougher re-election races, if you will. Maggie Hassan in New Hampshire, Reverend Warnock in Georgia, Mark Kelly in Arizona, Catherine Cortez Masto in Nevada. I know they're tremendous servants. I've been able to work with them up close and personal last couple of years. I know they were campaigning strong and smartly. And you take one look at their opponents and you think, yeah, they're going to get reelected. And so at a minimum, I felt we hold our 50-50 majority. I think the biggest piece for me is we had something to run on. We had a story to tell as Democrats. You think back to January 2021, when I joined the Senate, among the first things I had a chance to be a part of was the crafting and voting for the American Rescue Plan, right? We saw how the prior administration handled the COVID-19 pandemic, head of the sand, complete denial. In comes President Biden with a Democratic majority in Congress, and we delivered relief for families, relief for small business owners, for state and local governments, and funding for vaccines, because we followed the science. And we're in a much better place.
So let me just hold you up a second, because respectfully, I know those points. You think that this was an affirmation of Democrats. You don't think this was a reaction to extremism on the part of Republicans, the abortion decision of the court, the threat of the House to impeach everybody with for things to be determined later.
I think it was both. Elections are always about contrast. You have a choice.
Yes.
This candidate, this is what you're going to get. That candidate, that's what you're going to get. So with Democrats, we knew what we want more of. With Republicans, we're getting the majority. What's at risk? The Dobbs decision, undoing 50 years of protections under Roe v. Wade, was just the beginning, right? And just on abortion, for example, I mean, post that decision by the Supreme Court, Mitch McConnell said, hey, if Republicans regain the majority, a national abortion ban is in play. That was very public. And then they didn't even wait until the November elections. Lindsey Graham introduced the ban. And so that was very real. You heard our response after the Dobbs decision. The way in which the Supreme Court went about it put all of a sudden into jeopardy so many other rights that we thought had been settled, whether it's interracial marriage, you know, on and on and on.
You know, one of the interesting things on abortion, well, first of all, let me just say, on a lot of the issues that you mentioned, on climate for sure, Democrats had an edge. On a lot of these other issues, actually, Republicans had an edge in the exit polls on the economy, you know, on crime, on some of these other issues. But on the abortion issue, one of the interesting things that I saw in this election, and this was brooded about even in the polling beforehand, in states where people felt comfortable that their abortion rights would be protected by their state governments, it was less of a driver of vote than in states like Michigan and Wisconsin and places where who the governor was, who the legislature was, actually might affect people's abortion rights. And of course, in Michigan, they had a issue on the ballot there.
But to your point earlier, I think abortion moved a lot of people because of abortion itself. The Dobbs decision moved a lot of people because of the dynamic of extremism. The other significant example this cycle was so many election deniers running for office for United States Senate, for a governor, for attorney general, for secretary of state, which is personal to me because of some of the position I served
in before the Senate. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so again, you can discuss and debate tax policy. You can discuss and debate health policy. But when voters see that there's one party in particular that is disproportionately trying to undermine confidence in the electoral process, that throws everything, puts everything at risk. And we saw the response to that.
First of all, you may have, if Georgia goes back to Reverend Warnock, you may have a 51st vote. What difference does it, obviously control means a big difference there to begin with in terms of judges and other appointments. But in terms of control, I think a 51st vote means something too, doesn't it?
Oh, I think it's hugely significant in a way that most of the public doesn't understand. It's been tough enough to explain the 50-50 majority, where Vice President Harris has been particularly busy breaking ties. But a 51st vote isn't just one more vote, a little bit of wiggle room. Not everything goes by way of, you know, Senator Manchin, for example. But just the way the Senate operates, what a lot of people don't appreciate is when it's a 50-50 Senate, every committee is evenly split 50-50. So you have a bunch of deadlock tie votes in committee. There's ways to pull a measure out of committee to the full Senate for a vote, but it takes extra steps, extra votes, extra time. It's very inefficient. Just having that one vote margin in committee can continue to have party line votes, but the business of the Senate will proceed more efficiently as a result. So that one vote does make a big, big difference.
What do you expect the impact of a very, very closely decided House to be? Because it looks like it could be a little chaotic over there.
Yeah, honestly, I think it's a TBD. It depends on which a faction of the Republican Party ends up running things. And the same goes for the Senate, for that matter. Is it going to be a little bit of a return to, relatively speaking, rational, reasonable Republicans willing to negotiate, find common ground and bipartisanship? Well, I think there's a lot that we can continue to make progress at, like investing in infrastructure and things of that nature.
I thought you guys did relatively well under the circumstances over the summer and spring and summer. I mean, you passed the infrastructure bill, the CHIPS bill for manufacturing and right.
And even the Safer Communities Act, right?
Yeah, the gun bill, which, exactly. You know, these are things that administrations have tried to get done for a long, long time.
Right. And but it's up to the Republican conferences in both houses to make that determination. Or will the faction that prevails be the extremists, the election deniers? There's a challenge to Congressmember McCarthy trying to become the Speaker of the House. There's a challenge to Mitch McConnell to retain his leadership amongst Senate Republicans. So we'll see not just who prevails, but what agenda prevails within their conferences.
And at what price do they prevail? Because,
exactly.
You know,
exactly.
you can serve, but you could be beholden to those who allowed you to serve. And that's particularly germane in the House. You know, you mentioned the election deniers, and earlier you said you knew how good your colleagues were, but you knew how, essentially what you said was you knew how vulnerable their opponents were. Those opponents were largely chosen by Donald Trump chosen on the basis of their fealty to the election denial canard. In many of these states, stronger candidates would have put up much stronger races, and Republicans are going to have to assess that.
They have some soul searching to do on that and so many other issues. I think to me at the core, there's a couple of things. One, we've had for years now this debate between access to the ballot, election integrity, security versus voter suppression that we've seen. Should you need an ID to be able to exercise your right to vote? Should we, restore federal voting rights protections that were undone by the Supreme Court? Well, I'm eager to debate and fight about that. But when clearly people are running for office denying the outcome of previously audited and certified elections, I think in the minds of voters, they think, well, it can be easier to vote or harder to vote. But if I vote and it doesn't matter because you have a conspiracy theorist that's going to overturn it anyway, that's suppression at its very, very worst.
I don't want to get out of order here, but as long as we're on this issue, you were California Secretary of State. You were the authority on election administration there. You were behind the move to liberalize same-day registration and other things that made it easier for people to vote. How consequential were the Secretary of State races in places like Arizona, in Nevada, in Michigan, in Minnesota, places where states that are closely contested states, where you had people who were avowed election deniers?
Yeah. Well, let me set a little context here, because I think it was important in 2020, hugely important this cycle, and will continue to be important in 2024 and beyond. But a lot of what has driven my work in the election space is the 1994 National Voter Registration Act, which was approved on a bipartisan basis in Congress, where it includes in the findings that government has a responsibility to facilitate voter participation. So to me, that's proactive. That's not a passive, well, let's just make sure mm-hmm. there's no cheating involved. We have a role in facilitating participation. Imagine mm-hmm. that every ballot cast should be counted, even if it takes a few extra days to do that, to determine who the winner is.
Senator, let me ask you about that, because one of the things that you hear a lot, and not just from Republicans, is, gee, here we are 8 days after the election as we speak, and we're still counting. California will be counting for some time here. And people's, it lends to a narrative that somehow the thing is untoward. What do you do about that? And how do you, justify the length of time that it takes to, obviously you want to do it right. You want to make sure that people who cast votes are eligible to vote. And I'm sure that's a lot of what takes time. But what can be done to expedite this process?
Well, I think it's twofold. What can we do to expedite the process versus what can we do to better inform and educate the public as to what's going on, so you don't leave as much room for the conspiracy theories and the lies? I'll give you one beautiful example, because every state's a little bit different, but in California, we have a postmark bus law, which means that if you're voting by mail, as long as your ballot is postmarked on or before election day, it can arrive afterwards and still should be counted because you sent it off on time. Now, we can't control the postal service. So if it takes them 3 days to deliver the ballot to the county or a week to deliver the ballot to the county, that's why here we are a week later still trying to determine how many ballots came in. But they should be counted because that's, it's driven by voting rights for states that have automatic registration. Well, the registration has to be processed first before the ballot is counted. So there's a little bit of legwork on the back end. And that's what you see happening to different degrees in different states. The other thing about California, and this is a good problem to have, it's you're dealing with the dynamic of sheer volume. David, I am proud of this fun fact. There are more voters registered in the state of California than there are people in Florida. Think about that. That's a lot more ballots to count in the Golden State than most other states. So that's going to take a little bit longer. But ultimately, it's better to get it right than to get it fast.
I know I don't want to get into sort of cross-country rivalries. Florida seems to do it in an expeditious way. Why are they able to do that?
Well, they can do it expeditiously, but doesn't mean that everybody who's eligible has an easy time registering or easy time voting. So you got to really look at all these policies in totality and how they work together.
Let's talk about you. You mentioned your parents. Your parents were immigrants. As you pointed out, yours is sort of the great American story. You grew up in the San Fernando Valley there. You had this sort of extraordinary kind of trajectory. You went from high school to MIT and you studied mechanical engineering. And then you came back to LA and you got a job at Hughes Aircraft and you worked there, but not very long. Talk about what drew you away from the thing that you trained for to politics.
Well, I think important context here is, the earlier part of what you said, proud son of immigrants. I saw my dad work sometimes multiple jobs at a time to keep a roof over our head and food on the table, working as a short order cook. My mom cleaning houses, right? Hard work, honest work. And their dream in life was that my brother and my sister and I could get a good education because they didn't have that opportunity. That was abundantly clear. And in high school, thinking, well, I like math, believe it or not, and somehow did well in science. Engineering is what counselors and teachers pushed me towards. And what better school than the Massachusetts Institute of Technology? So even when I went there, I knew it was a chance of a lifetime for me, but the fulfillment of my parents' dreams after all their struggle and sacrifice. Mm-hmm. MIT was tough. 4 years later, coming home with that mechanical engineering degree, ready to start my career. Here is the political climate I came home to. The year was 1994. Governor Keaton Wilson at the time was up for re-election, tough re-election. And he was supporting a measure we refer to as Proposition 187. I saw the governor on television basically saying the economy is going downhill. The state of California is going downhill and it's the fault of people like your parents and families like yours. That's what I took away from that campaign. So you're damn right. I was pissed. I was insulted. And I realized that I might have been a little cynical, as a lot of young people are, about politics, but I had no choice but to get involved. And so I started, I think, organizing before I knew what organizing was, reaching out to friends and neighbors and encouraging people to register to vote and pushing people to the polls. And less than 5 years later, I was running for office myself. I ran for city council at a pretty young age to represent home. And it's been a good journey.
I want to give your story all its due, so don't race through it. I just want to ask you one question. Was politics discussed in your home? Was it a topic? I mean, did you weren't one of these guys? I was one of these geeks who followed this stuff from the time I was 5 years old and so on. And what did your folks think when you said, you know what, I got this gold-plated degree from MIT and I'm going to go in and become an organizer?
Yeah, I mean, maybe bronze, maybe not gold, the bronze. Or the brass rat, that's what we call the rings.
MIT there. Would say any degree they get is gold. So
here's the thing. Growing up, were we a politically involved family? Not when it came to electoral politics. It may not shock you. Some of the lower income communities in Los Angeles during the 80s, we recall what the times were in the 80s with the crack epidemic and gang activity and whatnot. It was a rough neighborhood. Were my parents involved civically? Yeah, to the extent it meant having to organize neighbors and, pressure our elected officials to be responsive to the dangers and the threats literally on the street where I grew up. And working together, watching my parents organize and be activists to clean up the community put us on a lot of lists. So from then on, when it was time to shut down the landfill, we were called to go be part of those protests and demonstrations. When it came time to, maybe something at the school, we were called to the community meetings because we were identified as an active family. And so we were active politically in that sense, but not around Democrats, Republicans, or candidates for office necessarily. It wasn't until after 187 where I connected the dots in my mind that the issues we care about at a neighborhood level, who your representatives are or aren't, makes a big difference, and we should be equally involved in the campaign side of things. That's how it started.
Well, 187 was an example of that because it did pass despite your efforts. It was set aside by a federal court, And then it was a Democratic governor, Gray Davis, who decided that the state would not appeal.
Yep. I worked on his campaign in 1998 before running for council in 1999.
You worked on a bunch of campaigns. You managed an assembly campaign as like a 22-year-old for a neighbor from down the street named Tony Cardenas, who is now your congressman. And you managed several other legislative races before you ever. And then at 26, you got elected to the city council.
Right. Exactly.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show.
I started as a city hall reporter in Chicago. And I've always believed, and I ended up as a strategist and as a media consultant doing mayoral races and city races around the country. And I've always thought that, and I saw some quote from you somewhere saying, I actually think local government is the most exhilarating and interesting and vital level of government because you're dealing with quality of life issues that really touch people's lives in a very integral way. Tell me about your early years as a member of the city council.
Yeah. So it was an honor to represent Hull, really. I mean, I ran for office. It was the very neighborhoods where, you know, not just I grew up in, I went to the local schools, played in the local parks. My sister was still in the classroom as a teacher at the time. And so there was a lot of local connections with a lot of need, right? We saw a city government in general that wasn't as responsive. And I would tell the staff that I assembled, all filled with folks who were from the district as well, that, you know, we're not just going to take this responsibility, but let's look into the lens of a working person's daily life, right? When you get up in the morning, what are you thinking about? Do I have a good enough job to be able to provide for my family? What are we doing in economic development, right? If I'm trying to send off my kids to school, do I have confidence in the quality of those schools or the support for those schools? So what are we doing to influence education and after school programs and recreation, et cetera? Can people afford a place to live, right? What are we doing on a housing development or affordable housing? Just through the lens of people. And of course, nothing more fundamental than, do you even feel safe where you live?
Right. I know that you, and I know you emphasized all those things, but one of the first things you did was you brought a new police station to your area. You got the site for a new police station. The reason I ask you this is because, you know, we're still grappling with these issues today. And the tension between the desire and the need for public safety and for good policing and the desire and the need for civil rights for all citizens. And you've seen it play out in our politics, right? Because in this last election, you know, the issue of defund police versus more police, you know, what do you say to your fellow Democrats about how to address that issue? Because as you say, both things are important. Everyone needs to feel safe in their own communities. And in many cities and in many communities, it's communities of color that also have the greatest safety issues.
Exactly. So I think it does come back down to this level of involvement and organizing and participatory society at the very grassroots level. Show me a community where the neighbors are active, whether it's through the PTA at school, whether it's through a neighborhood watch or a homeowners group or any other way that a community is involved with each other, and neighbors tend to know each other. And I'll tell you, that is not where a lot of the bigger problems when it comes to crime and safety exists. It's where the communities aren't as engaged or aren't as involved, where when the neighbors don't know each other, aren't looking out for each other as much, that creates the opening. And so when I'm going back to my days on city council, one of the things I'm proud of is we identified where those neighborhood watches or homeowner groups were, where they weren't, and let's go organize because that was such a key to doing that. Plus, you want to talk about community police relations. Even when the police officials aren't as, you know, sometimes they're very receptive. When they're not as much, their first excuse is, well, we don't even know who to talk to. Well, let's take that excuse off the table. And you bring them to the meeting and you organize the neighbors and you start creating that dialogue for relationship. And then you kind of expand from there.
Well, I just was wondering whether you thought that the whole discussion about defunding police was an unhelpful discussion. And did it hurt Democrats? Has it hurt Democrats?
Yeah, it's a catchy phrase, but I think when it comes to governance and policymaking and leadership and organizing, right, there's more than just how many characters in a tweet. The work is really in informing, educating. When I get the questions about defund the police, whether it's in the Judiciary Committee here in the Senate or at events back home, you kind of just, well, let's take our breath here. What is it that we're talking about? Ask any law enforcement expert, and they will tell you the best way to reduce crime is to prevent it. So how do we do that? Imagine that, the audacity to invest more in education, invest more in positive alternatives for young people to expend their energy, right? Kids, again, as a father of three, kids have energy and they need to get it out. And we're going to give them healthy ways to get that energy out, whether it's through sports or whether it's through after school programs, or they're going to find a way and we're taking a gamble. So investing more in prevention.
Should that come from police budgets? Should there be fewer police and more of those programs? Or is it either or is it more of both?
Every jurisdiction is a little bit different. I think in some jurisdictions, if they're spending part of their budget and trying to acquire unnecessary surplus military equipment from the federal government, yeah, maybe you can redirect some of those funds. But if you're talking about another jurisdiction that's already understaffed and pressed for resources, then yeah, maybe it's not about cutting their budget, but elevating the budget for other initiatives in the community.
I accept everything you say. I just hold on to your first thought, though. Public safety is paramount. People need to feel safe in their own communities. And that's something that everybody ought to embrace as a goal.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And law enforcement has to make sure we're keeping up with the type of training that they're getting, the type of culture that we're creating within those departments. So it is a relationship that is respectful of the community that they're charged to protect.
And cooperative, which is the kind of relationship that inspires cooperation, because that's necessary to combat violence as well. You got elected president of the City Council of Los Angeles, which is a powerful city council. In Chicago, the city council is traditionally been sort of tamed by mayors. In L.A., the city council is very, very powerful. You became president of the city council at the age of 28. There were people on that city council longer than you were alive.
That's not an exaggeration, Dave. When I first was elected.
No, I'm not. I know that.
That was half the welcome to the councils included some form of, I've been on this council since you were in grade school, or in the instance of a former council president, John Ferraro, I've been on this council longer than you've been alive. 2 years, aside from trying to get to the work that I knew my district needed, right? Addressing a lot of the core issues of potholes and graffiti removal and, public safety and whatnot. I was also trying to develop the rapport with my colleagues, because I knew that when they tell me, oh my God, you're my son's age, or I needed to make sure that I overcame that to be able to take him seriously as a colleague. And I think, the best example of being successful in that was when I earned their trust to lead the body 2 years later.
Then you had shortly thereafter kind of a baptism of fire, because 9/11 happened. Mm-hmm. The mayor was out of the city. By statute, the president of the city council becomes the acting mayor. So you were the acting mayor when all this went down.
Right.
What was that experience like?
Long days, starting with the morning of 9/11, getting a call from a friend of mine saying, hey, there's something happening in New York. You're in politics. You may want to be aware of what's going on. The first tower was already smoking. I saw the news cut to the Pentagon, and then the news cut back to the second tower in New York. Quickly realizing that the mayor's out of state, and so I'm the acting mayor. If our nation is truly under attack, Washington, D.C., New York, who's the predictable third target? It'd be Los Angeles. And so the phone started lighting up from the chief of police and the emergency operations personnel, the fire chief and the airport director. I had to just grab whatever suit was ready to go and get myself downtown. And that began several days of living in the bunker, a few floors underneath City Hall, trying to gather intel, working with our county, state, and federal partners told by the emergency operations experts, as the face of the city at the time, how do we keep calm in this city, particularly when the intelligence at the time said that no credible threats against Los Angeles. But how do you tell people that when they're seeing the replays on the news over and over and over again?
Well, and also, Warren, what some of those planes headed west or scheduled to head west?
Exactly. So it took a minute to realize, well, yeah, the reason they were planes going from Boston to Los Angeles was because they'd leave Boston with full tanks of fuel.
Right.
That would make for bigger, you know, more damage when they hit their intended targets. The other piece, and this is personal and important, David, you know how diverse, beautifully diverse Los Angeles is.
Yes.
And so immediately after, you know, the attacks, and there was some quick assumptions as to who might have been behind it and who not, we had to rally the city around, let's not prejudge our own neighbors. Let's wait to get official information to come out as to who might be behind these acts of violence. And one of the proudest moments, I remember being a part of a candlelight vigil on the steps of City Hall a couple of days later, where it was, you know, the diverse fabric of not just Los Angeles, but America. People from all walks of life coming together as patriots, proud America, to make sure that, again, we didn't immediately come to conclusions, but our own neighbors, that we stood up against xenophobia, not just against terrorism and everything else.
I remember, I mean, I was a precocious kid and I was managing campaigns. I loved newspapering and was managing campaigns, big campaigns when I was 28 years old. I wasn't in charge of a city. I wasn't in charge of, in the middle of a life and death crisis. Were there moments when you just said, holy cow, what am I doing here?
Maybe my colleagues might have had a one or two of those. But, you know, you just, I guess you got to have faith that, you know, you're in this place at this time in life for a reason. Have a little bit of an education, if not a long history in city government, at least, you know, general politics and government and public service to lean on. None of us does this alone. Right? One of the best lessons I learned pitcher growing up playing baseball was, you know, you got seven players behind you. Use them. Right? You don't have to strike out every batter. You get them a ground ball, ground out to the second baseman. That's a sometimes more efficient, but you got to play as a team. And I think I approached 9/11 and a whole lot of issues over the years, working as a team with several of my colleagues. I think the one point where I am kind of proud of in hindsight is, so we have these press conferences a couple times a day telling people go back to normal. And I ask from the police department, the police chief to the sheriff to everybody else, how do we know the city heard us? And they were sort of scratching their heads like, well, what do you mean? And I'm saying, well, based on intelligence, there's no credible threats. We're telling kids to go back to school, people to go back to work. How do we know people heard us? And there was this awkward silence. And then my light bulb goes off and I'd say, wait a minute, where's our liaison to the school district? What school, what's attendance today? Because if 80% of the kids are back in school, then the people heard us. If it's 10%, they haven't heard us. What's ridership today, right? If it's a big percentage, they heard us. If not, they didn't. We've got those communication lines are there for a reason.
You went to the state Senate. I guess was this a term limit issue or did you just decide that you wanted to go to the state Senate?
A little bit of both. You know, I had a great run at the city. I was in my final term. So I had a political mortality in front of me, but an opportunity to work on some bigger issues. You know, as much as a city council member in Los Angeles can do, if you want to impact education or healthcare or some of the bigger issues, the state legislature is an opportunity to make that kind of an impact.
What do you think about term limits? Because it seems like in California, you have people who serve, and I honor the service, but move around quite a bit because the term limits require it. So you have people moving from the assembly to the Senate or the Senate to the city council or vice versa and so on. What do you think about that system? Does it work? What is the effect of it?
Well, I can't sit here and say I'm completely opposed to term limits because I don't think I'd be here if it wasn't for term limits creating the opportunity for me to run.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But I do think they need to be balanced. When term limits are too short, it doesn't allow you the time to develop the experience and the skills as a policymaker, as a leader to make an impact before you're, maybe jumping or running to the next position. I think I've tried to strike that balance myself, 7.5 years on the city council. Not to get ahead of any of your questions, but 2 full terms, 8 years as a state senator. I was in my finished 6 years as Secretary of State in California before getting the call for the U.S. Senate.
Yeah. I just want to ask you one question about the state Senate, because you were very active there, as you are in the U.S. Senate, on the issue of climate change and developing policies to help thwart climate change. California, it has become the norm to see these horrific forest fires, and we've have increasingly urgent emergencies around the country, hurricanes and floods and so on. We're in a race here. Are we going to win this race? What has to happen in the next few years to see that we do?
Oh, we have no choice. We have to win this race. Our children and other future generations are depending on us winning the race. Like, I feel this is one of the great sweet spots that I'm able to leverage my state legislative experience now to these national policy discussions and debates. California has been a leader because we have been an exhibit A on climate change. You know, wildfires are just one example.
Yeah, but also leading the country. When you set, for example, fuel efficiency standards, the auto industry has to respond because you're such a big market.
Right. Leveraging the power of the marketplace that is California. And frankly, under former Governor Brown, continued by Governor Newsom, being able to enter into international accords without it being the United States and another country, but the state of California and either another nation, another province, that sort of thing. And so we get to have these climate change debates in Congress. And I can offer an idea that's not just, well, I think it's a good idea. Let's try and see if it works. I can point to measurable progress made by the state of California.
You guys took a big step forward, obviously, in this year with the package that you passed to invest in climate action. Are you confident that we will get ahead of this? How much does the government's role in this matter? How much can the private sector, local municipalities and states and so on, take us there? And how much does federal leadership matter?
It's all hands on deck time. There's definitely a role for local governments to play, whether it's a municipality that owns their own electrical utility or can leverage their power as a customer of a larger privately owned utility. State policymaking matters. And of course, the federal government policymaking matters and the role that we choose to play on a global scale. As we're talking right now, President Biden is in Asia. And this is the topic of the convening with the G20 and others around the world. Climate change is an existential threat, and it needs to be treated as such, which means not just policy, but investments. So the Inflation Reduction Act, which with its huge climate change elements of it, following up on the bipartisan infrastructure law from last year, are historic, tremendous, but more needs to be done.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files.
And now, back to the show. You had a long-time alliance with Governor Newsom long before he was governor and before you've had the positions you've had. He appointed you to the Senate. Talk to me about him. I'm not going to ask you if about him running for president in 2024 because you will give me the pro forma answer that Joe Biden's going to run and you'll support him. But what about Newsom as a national leader? And do you think at some point he will be someone who will emerge in the as a whatever year it happens to be as a candidate for higher office?
I hope there's an opportunity to serve that always is present in some sort of capacity. I'm sure he'll have options. Governor Newsom, when his time as governor is done. You know, we first met back when he was running for mayor of San Francisco. I was council president at the time. We were introduced by mutual friends. I took an immediate like to him, supported him in that race. Every race ever since, just as he's been a supporter of mine. But I think where we really bonded is both on policy work, right? Comparing notes on what are we doing to balance budgets in tough economic mm-hmm. times? What are we doing on affordable housing and homelessness going back decades? What are we doing on this and that? But also personally, we were both much younger at the time and over the years have compared notes on car seats versus boosters and mm-hmm. Had to balance, being a public servant with family life. While working together on issues you know, especially at the state level. When I was in the legislature, he was lieutenant governor. On the UC Board of Regents and the Cal State University Board of Trustees, where there's my legislation making it easier for community college students to transfer to four-year universities, or better protecting student athletes in California. I mean, just I can go on and on about examples of working together. So I like to think that when the opportunity to fill the vacancy created by Vice President Kamala Harris, it wasn't just the relationship, but the substance that we could lean on. So for him, like, he is tremendously bright. He is hardworking, driven by heart and values. To think that hopefully we're on the verge of codifying into federal law marriage equality because of the threat posed by this extreme Supreme Court. You know, it seems like not that long ago to me that it once upon a time was Mayor Gavin Newsom standing up for gay marriage in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And people thought it was too far out there. People thought he shouldn't have timed it. When he did the right thing, and he was on the right side of history. And that's just a perfect example, I think, of his boldness, his courage, and his work ethic, frankly. Every time I see him, he's always got a notepad next to him, and he's furiously taking notes.
You think he would sell nationally?
I think there's a lot of appetite for not just sort of the vision and the issues, but the boldness and the courage. I give him a lot of credit. So, you know, we're talking about how did Democrats fare better this cycle than people predicted. I think him taking a gamble on taking the fight to Texas and to Florida made a little bit of an impact, maybe locally, but was definitely seen and respected in a lot of places.
How would you compare him to your predecessor, the Vice President Kamala Harris, who's also obviously a national figure?
No, and she's great too. You know, I have a tremendous history of working with her. When I was council president, she was the DA in San Francisco. When I was in the state senate, she was attorney general of California during the foreclosure crisis, trying to hold banks and mortgage holders accountable. When she was in the Senate, she was my go-to. I think I was her go-to on election security legislation. You know, both tremendously talented, gifted individuals with a lot of you know, political skills to share. And as long as both of them and a whole lot of other folks that we've worked with are in public service, our country's a better off for it.
My goodness, I hope you're not going to have to choose between them. It sounds like it's going to be a wrenching decision for you if they should find themselves on the same path here. Let me ask you about three other things before we go. You talked before about your parents, and you talked about Proposition 187. The issue of immigration is still with us. As you point out, Trump got elected basically taking, you know, it was 187 on steroids. Is there an opening here? A few years ago, the Senate passed a comprehensive immigration bill. The House wouldn't take it up. What are the chances of doing anything on this issue?
As you know, you have to be an optimist in this business. Otherwise, move aside and let somebody else come in and lean in.
Let's stipulate your hopefulness, but I'm asking you as a realist.
Yeah, no, on immigration, I like to think something is doable. To be completely realist, as much as like a big comprehensive immigration reform bill to pass in the next 6 weeks, that's sadly probably not going to happen. But can we do something that's very targeted? Like, I mean, I think the front burner item is Dreamers. There's tremendous public support for Dreamers. I hear it from my colleagues, not just on the Democratic side, on the Republican side even, sadly, only behind closed doors. So many members who say, I'm supportive in private. What are they going to say publicly and be willing to vote accordingly? Is it because they're afraid of Trump? Is it because they're afraid of being primaried? You know, what's going on here? I think the urgency that the current status of federal litigation poses to so many young people is a wake-up call. And if we're on the verge of the House flipping to Republicans, then this may be the last opportunity to do something meaningful for quite some time.
In terms of relationships between communities, you talk about what a beautifully diverse city Los Angeles is. There just was a municipal redistricting and a municipal race in Los Angeles, and there was an incident in which a recording was made of of the Latino caucus in the city council, in which some unfortunate comments were made aimed at a black member of the council, and frustrations were voiced because there were competitions for seats and for district lines and so on. you end up calling for the resignation of one of your old colleagues whose campaign you managed years ago. Is this a growing chasm? And when there's competition between aspiring groups, how do you overcome those kinds of divisions?
Look, let me be blunt here. When I heard the content of those tapes, I was offended as well and beyond heartbroken, because these are people that I know, or at least I thought I knew. And to hear that language, those words coming out of their mouth was a travesty for so many. And so just as I will be the first one to call upon any of my Republican colleagues for whether it's racist remarks, derogatory remarks to any group, we have to be consistent and call other Democrats out on it if and when that comes to light as well. And by the way, to think that one of the children of one of the council members was a target mm-hmm. as a father, you know, that struck yet another chord with me. Maybe hard to believe, but you got to trust me on this. That does not reflect the state of race relations or coalition building in the city of Los Angeles. I mean, it happened in the heat of a marriage race, and they're still counting ballots on that one. But I think as we come out of this chapter, a lot of the work that's been going on for years and years and years to build bridges between communities, not just the Latino community and the African-American community, but the Asian community, the LGBTQ community, the geographic communities in Los Angeles. I know because I was part of a lot of the phone calls behind the scenes saying, we can't let this set us back, you know, 20, 30, 40 years. This is the time that we got to hang together. And I think that's why you saw so many people from across the political spectrum come out denouncing the remarks and calling for the resignations. I mean, my God, all the way up to the president of the United States.
Yes. On the issue of Latinos in politics generally, there's been a lot of discussion. I'm sure you've been consulted a lot on the issue of how Democrats keep Latino voters in the tent, attract more Latino voters. In this past election, there was not the kind of erosion that people predicted, but yet there was erosion from the previous two elections of support for Democrats among Latino voters. What advice do you have to the Democratic Party to arrest that erosion and rebuild support in that community? Democrats still got a majority of those votes, let's be clear.
Right, by a lot.
And it differs from area to area, because we talk about Latinos, but the Hispanic community is really Hispanic communities. And you look at South Florida, that's quite different than L.A. or, you know, South Texas may be different than another place. But talk to me a little, educate me a little on what the challenges are within the Latino electorate and what the Democratic Party, you think the Democratic Party needs to do.
That's a couple of old adages kind of converging. Number one, to the point you just made, the Latino community is not a monolith. We're tremendously diverse. You know, couple that with, you know, everybody attributes it to Tip O'Neill. All politics is local. So there might have been some slippage in Texas and in Florida, South Florida, but there wasn't that type of slippage in Nevada, because there was a Latino community that helped make sure that Catherine Cortez Masto, the first Latina elected to the United States Senate, was reelected to another term. My advice to the party is not just come in every 4 years, 2 months before the election, trying to rattle people up saying this is the most important election of our lifetime. You know, to truly organize, you've got to be there year round. And it's when you're present and building that relationship, not just for the sake of building credibility, but understanding a community, that you can appreciate the differences between, like, it's diverse in New York, but let's just say, you know, the Puerto Rican community, the Dominican community there is going to be a little bit different than the Mexican American or the Central American community in Los Angeles versus the Tejanos on the southern, you know, border of Texas, or the Cuban community in Miami. By the way, there's a lot of Venezuelans and Colombians there. I mean, we are diverse mm-hmm. everywhere you go. 99% of the agenda is frankly the American dream. We talked about this earlier. When people want a good shot at a good job to be able to provide for their family and raise a family. They want good schools for their kids so that the next generation has it better. Access to healthcare, you know, safer communities, on and on. That's all Latinos want. How we communicate that, how we deliver that, how we also utilize the assets of Latino families to make our communities more vibrant, not just in the kitchen, by the way, but especially when it comes to our food, is a tremendous opportunity. And as the population grows and demographic shift across the country, I think more communities are experiencing that. And that is certainly the trend that's continuing into the future. So my fellow Democrats, learn a little bit of Spanish. Let's go knock on some doors. Let's have some meals around the table. These policy conversations will come and the engagement will come. The young people these days, the voting bloc from 18 to 25 is not just the most diverse set of voters in the history of our country. It's also the largest. So America, get ready.
I should leave it there because that was really well stated. But yeah, I just want to ask you about cultural issues versus economic issues. And there is a strain of cultural conservatism in many of these Hispanic communities, you know, particularly people who have been here for older voters, been here for a period of time and so on. Would you advise people, your colleagues, to focus more heavily on these economic issues with these communities, or is that not important?
Talking about economic opportunity is absolutely important, right? What I see far too often is, okay, a few words in Spanish and talking about immigration reform as if that is the entirety of what Latinos care about. Nothing could be further from the truth when it comes to whether it's religion or conservatism or something. I mean, the point is you talk to Latino residents in your district, in your state, whatever the case may be, and find out what's on their minds and what's on their hearts. For a long time, people thought, well, Latino community is predominantly Catholic, and we know where the Catholic Church is on abortion. But that's not the data if you look at the electorate today. The vast majority of Latinos support reproductive rights and choice. You talk about economic opportunity versus other issues. You know, there's a lot of entrepreneurism in the Latino community, a big concern for educational opportunity for the next generation. But it's really hard to hear that from one political party. The first thing you hear is they want you out, right? And so, again, this is a question challenged back to my Republican colleagues. You know, how receptive are they going to be on whether it's embracing fair, humane immigration reform or just diversity in general? Because it's really hard to start talking to somebody about the education or the economic opportunity or anything else if the first thing they hear from a party or the leader of a party is to deport them because they're all drug dealers and gang members.
Last question on this. You know, there's a growing evangelical movement among Hispanic voters, still predominantly Catholic, but is that an element of the growing conservatism among some of these voters?
That's a very interesting, newer dynamic that's very, very real. A question back, and this may be the subject of another hour-long session.
Yes.
How much of that is a reflection of our politics? Is how much of that is a reflection of the state of the church these days? So I think, yeah, there's been an opportunity created by some folks leaving the church for a number of reasons. But, you know, the evangelical churches more broadly as a political force in America, that's a whole other conversation.
Listen, it's been great to chat with you. I suspect that we'll have more conversations in the future because we live in dynamic times and you will be right in the middle of it, I'm sure. But again, let me end where I began. Congratulations on a really, really impressive victory in your own right, not appointed, now elected overwhelmingly to serve your state for another 6 years.
Thank you. Thank you. And if you'll indulge me, and I know you can appreciate this, I just, on the record here, I want to thank my wife, Angela, and our three boys, Roman, Alex, and Diego, for their not just love, but sacrifice in letting me do what I do.
100%. No one can appreciate more than people who've been in and around this the sacrifices that families make in order to allow people to serve and to support you in that. So God bless them, and I'm sure they're really proud of you. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Allison Siegel. The show is also produced by Miriam Finder Annenberg, Jeff Fox, and Hannah Grace McDonald. And special thanks to our partners at CNN. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.